Mini MBA, how are you? This is it. Session 5 of our Q&As, the last one we're going to do together. The course is not over, don't worry. We've still got many weeks to go. We don't finish really until the end of July, as you'll see in a minute. So this isn't goodbye or anything, but it is our final Q&A. We've got a few good questions, and I really want to first of all take you through the timings, the dates, all the exam information before we get into our Q&A. Okay, so let's do that first, and then we'll get into some excellent questions. So the exam, a few things to say about the exam up front. It is doubly optional. You don't have to do it. If you've watched every module and read the main reading, you will get a pass, okay? So it's, first of all, optional. Don't feel obliged. We're a grown-up program for grown-up people. The exam's your choice, okay? And even if you do the exam and you do shit on it, the grade is optional. I'll explain in a minute, but if you got a grade that for whatever reason you felt was bad, you could just get the pass certificate and keep it quiet. So you can do the exam without any risk, okay? It's also not a huge ask, okay? We ask everyone when they finish an exam on the mini MBA how long it takes them. The average is about 6 hours. Some people do take longer. That's about them, not about the exam. But we're going to give you 2 weeks to do this exam, and you've got to find 6 hours, not necessarily sequential, okay? It's unimportant in the scheme of things. The most important thing is doing the course. So don't feel like this is, you know, I don't believe there's any correlation between exam performance in marketing exams and marketing quality. I'm not just saying that, I don't believe it, right? But I would encourage you to do the exam because it's really part of the learning. We haven't covered marketing planning. This is the part of the course where marketing plans come together. And also the whole course should clink together as well. And look, it's fun. It really is a fun exam. It's one of the second most common piece of feedback we get about the exam is it's fun. The first one is it's horrible, but you know, that's the fun. So here are the dates. Okay, let's go through what's going to happen from now on. As of this morning, the 16th of June, the exam tile is live, okay? So that's been closed throughout the course. If you go and look on your platform today, you'll see in that far left corner there, that tile is now open and you can click on the red box that says exam. When you do that, it opens up its treasures. And there are 5 treasures to be had, right? The first one is the case study. We call it, what do we call it? The workbook. But basically, this is the content that you need to read in order to crunch to do the exam. The next thing we've got there is the marketing plan for 2024. Now, note that this is a PowerPoint file. This is your exam. We're not asking you to type up Word files and other things. That's weird. Excuse me. What we want you to do is as explained in the back end of Module 10, is basically create a marketing plan. And I should mention that you should finish Module 10 before you go near the exam, partly so you've done the course before you start the exam, but also because at the back end of Module 10, I go into a lot more detail about what's expected. Okay, have a look at that. But this is what you're going to submit. It's a PowerPoint deck. You can't muck around with the templates. What you have to do is basically fill them out as instructed in the back end of Module 10, using the knowledge from the workbook, okay? The third thing you're going to see there are the communication options from Carol Spencer. So at the back of this workbook, there are 2 links to 2 different videos. One from your new boss, Jim Morton, strange man, and the other from Carol Spencer, who works for the agency that supplies you with astonishingly shit options for communications. That's presented to you in video form, but this is the hard copy of the Prezzo. When you get to the stage in the marketing plan where you have to pick tactics, you have to pick from Carol's smorgasbord of options, and they're all contained here. Okay, so they're the 3 things you need. There's a couple of other extra things in the tile. There's an article by Professor Sally Dibb, who's a very good British marketing professor, talking about marketing planning that will help in the exam. And there's a column of mine also talking about how to get marketing planning right. That will also help. Okay. So that's the material. Basically, you read the case study, you choose from these Aspire options, and then you complete your plan. Fill it all out. And when you're happy with it, you then go back to the tile, browse, find the file, and click submit. Now, once you submit, we cannot change your submission ever, okay? We start grading them as soon as we get them, so we're not going to give you a second chance. So when you finish the exam, for goodness sake, don't send it the next day. Sit on it for at least a day until you're sure you're ready, okay? All right, so that's how you do the exam. The submission date is June the 30th, okay? Now, remember, throughout that period, use the MBA network to talk to your fellow mini-MBAers and me about questions you have about the exam. We're happy for people to discuss what the options are. Just remember that don't change your approach because someone very authoritative is suggesting an alternative. They're probably dumber than you, okay? So there'll be lots of different experts telling you what they think is the right answer. You do what you think's best. I will check every day the network and respond to any questions about the exam, post them on the MBA network, and I will, where possible, I will respond, okay? The deadline at the end of the 2 weeks to submit your marketing plan slash exam is midnight UK time, June the 30th. At that point, the tile closes, okay? We can't do extensions. Then what happens is we just grade. We manually grade them, it's true. We haven't yet got AI working. God knows we're trying. And 3 to 4 weeks later, we're ready. And on July the 28th, two magical things happen. First of all, you get your certificate, which you can either have with your grade, if you did the exam or ungraded, which you can download from the site from that day onwards. And we will also then, on that day, publish your course conclusion module. That's me, kind of like this, reviewing the exam, looking at some of the best, my favorite answers, who did best, what the right answer was this time around, and also, importantly, drawing the class to a conclusion, future learnings, etc. That looks like this. So this tile will open on the 28th to get your certificate, and this tile will open for the course conclusion. Then you have one more week until we close the platform down on August the 4th at the end of the week. So in that time, you can rewatch the videos. You can download all the material. We paid for the copyright. It belongs to you. You can download your certificate because on the 4th, we have to close it down to get ready for September when we start again. Okay. Now, that means you're like, whoa, don't leave me. Don't leave me in the darkness. Don't worry. As soon as we close the platform, we'll then reach out and explain to you how you join our alumni. When you signed up for the course, you also got a free year in our alumni as well. The alumni is like a much bigger version of the MBA network that you've been on already, but with another 6,000 people, with all kinds of talks from alumni, career stuff, events. And crucially, as I update the modules, which I do 4 modules each time, you'll have access to all the classes forever as they evolve and improve, okay? So it's cool. You can join all that and you can stay here forever. Does that make sense? Okay, let's move back to our Q&A because we have some good questions that I want to get through in the remaining time we have, okay? All right, let's kick off with Rob. Hey, Rob. My question comes from this Lampler. You know, it's not Lamplu. You know that, of course, Rob. It's Lampler. Lampler is in West Cumberland, where I'm from. And my first girlfriend, who was called Fiona, came from Lampler. So I am, I don't know if you pronounce it Lampler, but you should, because that's it's a Lake District name. Anyway, Rob, Lampler. My question comes from the section of the IMC chapter of the course, calculating the S-curve. Yes. The model is brilliant and helpful for considering how to maximize budget across channels, but also across segments. That's interesting. My question is, how do you go about measuring the impact based on your objective? For instance, I work with a lot of brands with small budgets, and being precise and confident on channel selection is vital. How can you assess the impact of channel across multiple channel options to find the most optimum? Many thanks. Yeah, now this is the problem with the S-curve. I'm a fan of it too, Rob. The problem with it is, in practice, the only real way to measure impact in sort of expenditure terms is through very good media agencies who've already got established models for, if you spend X on Y media, you will probably achieve Z level of impact in terms of awareness. It is very difficult to assess this. Now, as it comes down the funnel, one of the great strengths of digital media is it's much easier to observe in real time that your impact is starting to decay because you've reached that curvilinear point and you're probably putting too much on that one and you can move it elsewhere. It's much harder to do even after the fact. So the reality is it's more of a mental model for most smaller brands. For the bigger brands, they absolutely estimate, usually through modeling, where the maximum point is for each of their different channels, and then that's how they essentially move their money. But for smaller brands, it's more, I introduce it more as a way of explaining to smaller clients, I know you love Facebook advertising, but you shouldn't just double, triple down there. At some point, it will make more sense to move your money to something else. And the S-curve, I think, is the best way to explain the root of integration's power, if that makes sense. It is possible to do, but only big agencies, proper media agencies, can really pull this out. Hannah Murphy, I have a question around scaling a D2C brand. Seeing as a lot of the time, part of the disruption of a D2C is the price and being able to offer cheaper products. Assuming that when you scale, you inevitably have to pay put up prices to account for additional marketing and distribution costs. And if so, if you were launching a D2C brand today, would you consider building these costs into your launch price versus putting up prices later? As I imagine, if your positioning is cheap, then that you would want your impact, your ability to scale, as you need to honor that cheap positioning. I love this question, Hannah. But I love it for the inherent, it's a great question, but there's an inherent flaw in your question. Can you spot what it is, Hannah? Let's pause, everyone, and think about, and Hannah, this is not having a go at you because I love your question. It might be question of the week, but there's something wrong with it. Hannah's point, which is a good one, is what do you do when you launch a D2C brand and because you have less comms expense and you certainly give up less margin to distributors, you've got a lower price point. And then when you start doing advertising and having to work with distributors, you have more costs, so you have to put your prices up. That all hinges on a single premise that I disagree with, which is that cost is driving any of your pricing decisions anyway. Yeah? It is, as we talked about it in the module, it is a station that we pass on the train and make sure we go past it. Goodbye, cost. We're moving into profit. But the actual price should be set on the nature of consumer demand, right? Price insensitivity. So really the correct answer to your excellent question, Hannah, is assuming I am profitable with my D2C and assuming I'm smart at pricing, I've already set my price at a very good place based on customer sensitivities and, of course, profit. So what happens when I scale up is I am less profitable, but it has no impact on price. Yeah, makes sense? But I love your question. But that now, whether that happens or not depends on how the D2C did their pricing, right? John, do all the videos, articles, and other resources from all the modules remain accessible during the exam dates? Yes. And as I've just explained, John, they also will exist in the alumni network afterwards too. So you've got plenty of time. If I was you, I would download all of the resources apart from the classes, which aren't downloadable. And then whenever I want to watch the classes, not that I want to watch myself, then go to the alumni network to watch them. So pretty much forever. You get a year free on the alumni network, and then you have to pay like £100 a year whenever you want to rejoin, which honestly, I know that's money, but it literally doesn't make any profit for Mini MBA. We use it to pay for running the alumni network and the people that run it. That's it's a not-for-profit. I mean, as close as we get to not-for-profit. You know, the rest of it's making profit. You know what I mean. Maya. Hey, Maya. Hi, Mark. Great final module. Oh, you got to the end. I'm keen to learn a bit more on parallels, correlation regarding industry type and to what extent marketing owns distribution. Which businesses would typically get this right and have marketing at the helm or have marketing get a chair at the distribution table or where marketing is completely excluded? I've worked with clients during my time at agencies, but also directly while at the client side. The majority of those businesses fell into categories B and C, often with sales leading distribution channels. I currently work in a niche, but huge B2B asset management segment. Distribution is D2C-like. Deals take 1 to 2 years to close, and there are no distribution partners or platforms involved. Perhaps a bit of an outlier. Yeah, maybe, but your question's a great one. And I prefer the way you put it, Maya, in terms of a seat at the table. In B2B, it's very, very, very difficult for marketers often to get involved in those distribution decisions. Not impossible. In B2C, there's more scope for it. But again, just like with pricing, I don't want marketers really to control distribution. I think the sales force are much better at it. I think logistics partners are much better at it. But I do think we need to be involved in it to help with the process. And so a seat round the table, A, B or C, should be viable. Chris Lineker. Hello, Chris. If established businesses well-versed in indirect distribution models are being disrupted by up-and-coming D2C millennial businesses, typically modelled on a Rundle pricing structure, why aren't the big businesses identifying this threat and getting in there first? Your Gillette Shave Club example was a reactive strategy to combat Dollar Shave Club. And if theoretically it introduces all sorts of channel conflict issues, thankfully I'm not going to prison, would it not make sense to be more proactive and create a D2C Rundle-based fighter brand, allowing the business to expand, but also keep it distinguished from the current traditional offering? Sure, that can only be done if it's not going to cannibalize original, but unless you've got ridiculous market share, it seems plausible. Am I missing something? In theory, Chris Lineker, you're not. In practice, you are. And so with hindsight, Gillette should have launched a second brand, which was sold direct online, but there's two reasons they didn't do it. That would have been stupid until Dollar Shave Club came along. They were making so much profit and they had such brand focus, it was a crazily good model. And if we'd have turned up, you and me, and suggested to Gillette, what you need to do now is launch a second brand, they'd have gone, you guys are losers, right? And I would have been part of that you're a loser conversation. Focus, right? Less products, more profitability. The second point is core competence. This is where it gets right to the heart of the competence question, yeah? Gillette are fantastically good at selling huge amounts of products through distributors and into mass retail, yeah? There's probably, P&G and Gillette, there's probably nobody better in the world at that, right? But by being good at that, they get shit at nimble direct distribution because core competence begets core incompetence, yeah? When I went to school, I played rugby, right? All the way through. And because I played rugby, I never got to dance in the ballet, yeah? In my school ballet team, if I'm making this up, right? Partly because the traits that God had given me were much better suited to rugby, but also as my rugby schedule got bigger and more demanding, I had no time left to dance ballet. So what becomes a strength also begets weakness. And that's why companies don't go into the things that an alternative company turns up and does. Just as the Dollar Shave Club has proven to be absolutely shithouse in getting into distribution and selling through in direct distribution, so too Gillette aren't very good at direct either. That's the point, right? And that's an intractable situation. Mayer, again, a question on segmentation. Any advice on adding critical influencers to the segmentation map? Don't do it. Third parties that seriously influence key target segments? Don't do it. In our industry, you have a small group of consultants that are hired by prospects to help with choices. They influence our prospects, but I find it difficult to value them. Over 90% of our prospective clients use these consultancy firms. You know what that sounds like to me, Mayer? That sounds like a segmentation variable. Put it in the axis. Use a consultancy, don't use a consultancy. Then break it down using other variables, using the meaningful actionable grid. And only when you have a segment identified and a portrait of that segment do you want to go into detail about what kind of consultant, what role do they play. It's a route to market. It's not the market itself, if that makes sense. And finally, to finish us off in style for this Q&A, our final Q&A, which has been short and beautiful, we have Tiffany Vigor. Hey, Tiffany. Thank you for this amazing MBA. Well, thank you, Tiffany. Great content with zero bullshitting. There's plenty of bullshitting there, Tiffany. It's just that you didn't spot it because I'm awesome at it. If I mentioned to you that my great-grandfather, Will Ritson, was the greatest liar in the world, This is all true. If you care to Google it, you will find Will Ritson from Wasdale, near to Lampler, funnily enough, bearing a striking resemblance, not really to me, but certainly to my dad, was the greatest bullshitter who ever lived. They have competitions now in his honour. That's how big a bullshitter he was. Or was he? And am I just making it up? Anyway, I have two questions going back to fighter Brandon Price. Okay. Number one, example of Loves from P&G turning a brand into a fighter brand to counterattack private label. Yeah. From your point of view, how can a fighter brand survive if the game is to maximise profit while providing low-value product to steal from private label? Which means cutting back on tactics. For example, IMC. Private labels benefit from the name of big retailers like Tesco, who have great awareness and trust the retailer. Whereas a fighter brand wouldn't benefit from this mental availability if it has to cut back on some of the key tactics to grow. I totally agree, Tiffany. The point here is with a fighter brand, that they often operate in categories like diapers or airlines where private label isn't necessarily your main rival. If you actually look at private label diapers or nappies, the penetration is relatively low in most countries. So the point is, you know, it wouldn't make sense to have a fighter brand maybe in things like milk, where, as you point out, private label is 60, 70% of the category. But in categories where private label penetration isn't as high, there is the option of a fighter brand alternative. So it's some categories you're right, some categories you're wrong. Number two, regarding the module around price, example of instant coffee category where 80% is sold on promotion. Yeah. How can an established brand play in this environment driven by price war against competitors and also with retailers with the current environment we live in? Example of all the loyalty cards with Tesco and Sainsbury and all Aldi where consumers get discount prices. Well, it's funny you say that, Tiffany. I wrote a column this week on this very topic. And on Monday, if you check Marketing Week now, you can read it. But I will post it on Monday as a follow-up, looking at a couple of case studies of how companies have gotten out of this category discounting addiction and live to tell the tale. Okay, I'll put a list up there. All right, that's it. That's your Q&A's done. Good luck for the next couple of weeks. You won't see me now until I come back. I'll be on the MBA network every day trying to help and carry you through the exam. And then we'll meet again in a month's time where we'll go through your exam, your pathetic exam, but also talk a lot about the course, next directions, follow-up readings, etc. Okay? Enjoy the next month. Try and squeeze time into the exam. I will miss you, but I will be on the network each day. And if you need anything or you've got any questions about the exam, ping me. And within 24 hours, I will respond if I have an appropriate answer. Okay? And help each other as much as you can in the exam. Enjoy the experience. And I'll see you in a month's time. Take care.